From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama was out apologizing last week for the accidental deaths of two al-Qaeda captives, one American, one Italian, killed in U.S. counterterrorism operations earlier this year by a drone strike against an al-Qaeda compound in Pakistan, putting American drone policy in the spotlight again. Its morality, its legality, its effectiveness, its consequences. This hour on Point, the cost and evolution of American drone warfare. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you okay with the drones out there, up there, killing in your name for American security? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the shooting death Friday night of a prominent, beloved civil rights activist in Pakistan, Sabine Mahmood, and the anguish her death is evoking there. But first, American drones and drone warfare. Here's the president on Thursday with his apology in the deaths from a drone strike in January of American Warren Weinstein, held by al-Qaeda since 2011, and Giovanni Laporto, an Italian aid worker held since 2012. The president.
As president and as commander-in-chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families.
And there was more, including this, from the deputy legal director of the ACLU, talking with NPR on Thursday, saying the U.S. doesn't know who it's killing.
I would say it raises troubling questions about the reliability of the intelligence the government is using to justify these kinds of strikes and the depth of that intelligence. You know, in each of these operations, the government literally didn't know who it was killing.
Joining me now from Washington is Benjamin Wittes, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, member of the Hoover Institution's Task Force on National Security and Law. Ben Wittes, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington, Andrew Coburn is with us, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, author of the big new book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Andrew Coburn, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
Ben Wittes, first to you. Was it shocking? Was it surprising? What do you make of the news that the president shared with the country last week that these two al-Qaeda captives had been killed?
Well, it's, of course, deeply, deeply tragic, and it's a terrible shock. And, you know, you surveil what was clearly an al-Qaeda compound, and you hit that compound, and that intelligence turns out to be correct. But what you don't know is that they're hiding captives in that compound, and you've ended up without targeting killing them as well. And it's certainly not what anybody at CIA was intending to do or wanted to do. And I assume the president is very sincere in his regret and shock at what happened.
Andrew Coburn, there's a lot we're going to look at here today, but first just this question of how the U.S. could not know that the captives were there. We're reading in the days after the apology and the announcement from the White House that the drones use heat sensors to count the number of people in any given structure, and these two were not accounted for. That's why when the bodies came out, we immediately heard there were too many bodies. I guess compared to the heat sensor signature there, how do you think these could have been missed, Andrew?
Well, pretty easily. I mean, they say heat sensors. This is plain old-fashioned infrared, which, you know, drones and military aircraft and a lot of troops on the ground use for night vision. And it's really not too surprising that they should have missed it because infrared IR, you know, misses a lot in the original tests of the drone sensors. It turned out that it could only really deliver a distinguishable image, you know, a difference in a tank and a truck or something, one-fifth of the time. So the fact that, you know, they're saying, oh, well, the al-Qaeda terrorists might have hidden their captives underground or in a tunnel, I mean, that's entirely possible. I mean, the fundamental thing to understand is this technology is very fallible. We are told they talk about precision. You know, the president's talked about the precise precision of these strikes. People really have to understand how fallible the technology is, and therefore, you know, maybe ask a question or two on, you know, why we're taking these life and death or death for some people decisions on the basis of an assumption of precision that isn't really there.
Andrew, can you describe for us the special exemptions that apparently have been carved out for the CIA in Pakistan? 2013, the president came out after a troubled period and called for significant reforms to the drone war program. Some of those not implemented in Pakistan to continue to give the CIA more latitude there. What is that latitude?
Well, the latitude is really they can what he said, what we were told was the provision was that they could only really kill someone when there was an imminent threat. They posed an imminent threat to the national security of the United States. But what we weren't told, and we now learn, that actually the CIA was told it's okay, you can kill someone even if they don't seem to pose an imminent threat to the United States. Basically, anyone who you deem to be al-Qaeda or a terrorist, even if you don't know who they are. I mean, as we saw in this recent strike as a vivid example, they got very unlucky, particularly unlucky for Mr., for the poor hostages, but, lucky in terms of killing a couple of people deemed to be al-Qaeda. But, this whole point about these signature strikes is proceed on the basis that if they're behaving like they're terrorists, I mean, they call it patterns of life, patterns of behavior, exhibit certain characteristics, and there are all sorts of complicated algorithms to help you make that decision, then you can kill them. But of course, you can get it terribly wrong.
Ben, the Wall Street Journal reporting today that these signature strikes, where they don't know who's there, but it has a pattern of behavior that they associate with al-Qaeda leadership, have been responsible for killing more al-Qaeda leaders than directly targeted strikes. How does this targeting work, Ben?
Well, so, the word signature strike is kind of mystifying of the whole subject, but signature strikes are what in normal warfare you call targeting, right? I mean, when you see an enemy position in a normal war, you don't know the individual identities of the persons who are manning it. And so you take certain telltale signs of what it means to look like an enemy position, and you target on the basis of that. And a signature strike is really no different from that, except, of course, that in a war in which people don't identify themselves by wearing uniforms and by rigorously separating themselves from the civilian population, it can be harder to distinguish and you can make more mistakes. So it's not surprising at all that signature strikes have been a fruitful form of targeting. On the other hand, you are, despite the precision of the instruments relative to other weapon systems that are available to strike from this sort of distance, and these are much more sophisticated at distinguishing, you are never going to achieve perfect discrimination, perfect targeting accuracy, and sometimes you're going to be surprised.
Ben, isn't there a difference here in that Americans have more or less been led, despite the sort of distasteful sound of it, to understand these drone strikes as assassinations, that these are precisely targeted killings of al-Qaeda leadership? Signature strike is something, it is more like traditional war, but it's not what Americans have, I think, been led to understand this program to be doing, for better or worse.
Right. So, it's a funny paradox of the drone war, right, that for, 100 years, we have been asking, and the human rights movement has been asking, and later the militaries themselves have been asking for abilities to distinguish more precisely between combatant and civilian. If you think back to World War II, we did aerial bombings of entire cities, right? And there was no effort to distinguish between military and civilian targets.
Dresden or Tokyo firebombing, you name it, many examples.
Correct, or London, mm-hmm. right?
And well, not us, but certainly.
Mm-hmm. Right, no, but both sides mm-hmm. did dreadful, dreadful aerial bombings of what was called strategic bombings of cities. And over the years, it's over a remarkably short period of time, the ability to target has gotten better and better and better and better until now you can actually aspire to hit you know, this compound over here, but not, but do it when, you know, the women have left the building for some reason. Now, you're not going to be perfect at that. But here's the irony. The more your ability to target actually looks like perfect discrimination, perfect distinction between civilians and targets, the more we come to think of it as assassination and sort of extrajudicial killing, and the less like normal warfare it looks. And then we develop this discomfort with it that's based, you know, that's ironically greater than the discomfort we would feel if we were simply shelling an area where we accept that there are certain civilian casualties that come with that.
There is a deep irony there, Andrew. We just have a minute before the break, but what about this argument? It's war, and this is more precise than shelling or firebombing or, you know, sort of general destruction.
What you have to say, we have to understand is that, you know, we've been aiming for this for years. They started World War II thinking that the U.S. Air Force thought that, you know, we can hit a select number of targets, 154, I think was the number, and that'll bring the German war machine to a stop. It always starts this way. Yes, we can be incredibly precise. Yes, we are now precise. I agree. But it always broadens. The list of targets always extends. And, of course, you know, the presumption of precision doesn't really come to fruition. And, you know, we've been trying to this. Of course, it's assassination. We call it assassination because it is assassination. We tried to kill Saddam Hussein, and we're still trying to win wars the same way.
You say starts this way? To some, it may look like ending this way or tapering this way. I mean, after all, the huge intervention in Afghanistan right next door was already there. There's a lot we're going to look at here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American drone policy and consequences. American and Italian al-Qaeda captives killed by American drone, and now again, questions about America's drone war. Benjamin Wittes is with us from the Brookings Institution. He joins us from Washington, co-author of The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting a New Age of Threat. Andrew Coburn is with us from Washington, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Here's the president again on Thursday talking about the fog of war.
It is a cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war generally and our fight against terrorists specifically, mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur.
And here's the president also last week ruminating more deeply.
It is a hard fact that U.S. strikes have resulted in civilian casualties, a risk that exists in every war. And for the families of those civilians, no words or legal construct can justify their loss. For me and those in my chain of command, those deaths will haunt us as long as we live.
That last from May of 2013, actually. This issue has been around. Ben Wittes, Andrew Coburn, please stand by. Let me get our listeners here. Jessica in Columbia, Missouri. Jessica, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Look, I just want to say that this exercise in national naval gazing isn't doing us any good. We have far less collateral damage than we've had in any previous engagement. Even going back to the Gulf War, we had far more civilian casualties involved with our operations against terrorist networks than we have now with the drone program. I don't think we're doing ourselves any good by demanding that we have 100% accuracy with no margin for error, because anytime that there's going to be war and anytime that you're going to engage anybody in a military fashion, there's going to be some margin of error. We've gotten that margin down very, very small. I mean, look at the linebacker bombings back in Vietnam. Those were horrific. And the Gulf War saw a great deal of damage across Iraq.
Jessica, I get it, but let me ask you this. How long could this go on and be okay for you? Is it all right for the world to perpetually understand that if you get on the bad side of the U.S., wherever you are, you know, death may come down from a drone in the sky? Is that all right? It's been many, many years now.
It's one thing to say on the bad side of the U.S. There's a lot of people who are on the bad side of the U.S.
Yep.
There's a differentiation between that and terrorist networks. Right now, Putin's Russia is on the bad side of the U.S. We're not sending drone strikes there.
True,
we're not
fair.
Sending drone strikes into Iran.
Yep.
We're going specifically after terrorist networks, and it is okay for us to say, no, we're going to continue going after terrorist networks because this manner of quote-unquote international relations is not acceptable. It is not acceptable to stand by and let terrorist networks continue to operate.
Jessica, I appreciate your call. Let us hear from you again. Andrew Coburn, it's national navel-gazing to worry about this at this point.
Well, I mean, it's true that we, you know, that the collateral damage is far less than in previous wars, although we don't know quite what it is because we have no really accurate figures. I mean, it's been claimed officially here that we're not killing any civilians, which turned out not to be true. They just they said that anyone we killed was post ipso facto a terrorist. Clear that one up. But I think there's another question to ask, which is, so let's assume for a moment that everyone we kill is a terrorist, is a terrorist leader. Is it doing us? Does it do us any good? I mean, the presumption is that we kill a terrorist leader, and that improves our position in the world and degrades the terrorist threat, and that's the basis for the whole thing, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there are indications, and I talk about this in my book, that that actually it makes your position worse. I mean, I'll give you one quick example, which was in Iraq in 2007. Military intelligence did a study of 200 times that they'd killed a local insurgent cell leader, or killed or captured, and then they looked to see what had happened then. And it turned out that attacks on Americans had gone up sharply, by as much as 40%, I think, within the first few days, because the dead leader is always replaced by someone, and it turns out the new leader always tends to be more aggressive, has to prove himself, has to make his bones.
Case in Al-Qaeda's instance, Andrew? I mean, we're reading the headlines now saying, you know, the drones have taken a big toll on Al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan. That's the kind of headline Americans would have been very happy to read not long ago when the fear of another 9/11 was so present.
Well, okay, yes. I mean, interesting coincidence that those headlines appeared right after this latest disaster. Is it true? I mean, I've been seeing some interesting reports that Al-Qaeda still seems to maintain a very fully functioning bureaucracy in that part of the world with people, you know, a steady payroll and people being put under house arrest if they misbehave and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, of course, we've seen the global terrorist threat expand enormously. I mean, ISIS, the Islamic State, now controls an area the size bigger than Utah, you know, 6 or 7 million people. So I would say if this has been our principal instrument in the war on terror, we're not doing very well.
How about it, Ben Wittes? Let's take the Al-Qaeda headlines on their face that there's been a toll. On the other hand, meanwhile, you've got ISIS exploding in Syria, in Iraq, and beyond. Does that say drones work, drones don't work? Should we bring them down all over the place?
You know, so I am not a military strategist, and I would hesitate to put myself out as somebody who has the definitive answer to that question. But I would say this, that you know, look, ISIL developed in a region of the world in which during a time in which we were not conducting military operations against them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
post the Iraq War, essentially.
We left, we stopped conducting military operations, and there was a resurgence in that area. So I think that you could argue that that drones have been an effective means in Pakistan of preventing and in Afghanistan of preventing exactly the sort of resurgence that we saw in Iraq. Now, I do think, you know, I agree with almost everything the caller said, except for one thing, which is her opening statement that this national navel-gazing over this subject doesn't do us any good. And I actually think it does. I won't quibble over whether it's national navel-gazing or not. But the truth of the matter is that this is an area in which the goals of military effectiveness and the goals of civilian protection are almost perfectly aligned, and that if you can discriminate really, really well between legitimate targets and civilians, you will be much more effective than if you cannot. And so I think there's actually a lot of value to focusing really hard on every time one of these strikes fails. And a lot of that has to be done in secret. But I do think the conversation is actually very valuable.
Andrew, speak to the precision issue. We heard you say they're not nearly as precise as advertised. We heard Ben stand up for the precision of these weapons compared to most or all others. What about this precision point? We're hearing now that maybe 2,000 people have died in Pakistan under American drones, and no one's claiming all of them were al-Qaeda leaders.
Oh, no, that's right. In fact, of the actual leadership as opposed to rank and file al-Qaeda and civilians, the proportion of leaders mm-hmm. is actually extremely small. I mean, yes, I mean, the precision is basically, you know, it's laser-designated targets. It's a technology that's been around for a while, and so they, you know, they are precision guided weapons, but they, I just have to read it. There's, you know, the great mistake is to think that they're absolutely precise. You know, the surveillance, the sensor technology, I mean, the things we get to see on YouTube and, you know, in films like Zero Dark Thirty make it look like, you know, they're looking at a view on the ground with absolute mm-hmm. clarity and, you know, sort of down to you can read a newspaper or a license plate and all that. That's not true. We know from, you know, things that go wrong, you know, a couple of years ago, there was some, a couple of Marines were killed in Afghanistan because the people watching the videos couldn't tell whether they were, they couldn't tell whether they were insurgents or Marines. I mean, they couldn't tell which way they were firing. You know, the sensor technology, as I keep saying, is not what it's cracked up to be. I mean, it's good, but it's, you know, intensely fallible. So to proceed on the basis that, you know, you're always going to get what the president's called precise precision is a big mistake, and it leads you into disasters, you know, like we just had.
Andrew Coburn, please stand by. In Washington, Ben Wittes. Representative Congressman Adam Schiff joins us right now from Los Angeles, Democratic U.S. Representative for California's 28th District, and he serves as ranking member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Congressman Schiff, thank you very much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Given your position on the committee, given how you must follow this, were you surprised by what we learned last week about the news of these most recent deaths of the American and the Italian in captivity?
Well, I had been briefed prior to the disclosure being made public, but certainly when I was briefed, it was a terrible shock and a grave tragedy. I can only imagine, I can't imagine the grief the families must have gone through.
Where do you stand on the drone program? Are we on the right track? Is the country, the policy on the right track? Is it in the right hands? Are we doing the right things, and is it the CIA that should be doing them or not?
Well, I've favored a transition where we have the Defense Department doing kinetic action and that we have our intelligence agencies focus on their core mission of intelligence gathering and analysis. So that's something where I'm in agreement with Senator McCain. I've also been pushing, along with Senator Feinstein, for greater transparency in these counterterrorism operations. I introduced legislation a year or two ago to require that we have an annual accounting of how many people are killed in these type of counterterrorism operations, how many civilians, how many combatants, and perhaps most importantly, how they are defined to make sure that we're holding ourselves accountable. We may be the first to have developed this technology. We won't be the last to employ it, and the standards that we set are going to, you know, we want to hold out as an example to others that use this this platform, this military tool. So I think it's important that we hold ourselves accountable and that we call for the highest standards possible.
You say base it in the Pentagon if it's kinetic or if it's active attack rather than the CIA, where you'd like to see intelligence as number one or maybe the sole activity. Of course, that's not what's going on. Could you just remind our listeners of who runs drones where and why this distinction has developed? The CIA doing it some places, the military elsewhere?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I can't go into that kind of detail because only fragments have been declassified. So I have to speak fairly generically, but my own view is that when we're talking about these type of operations, they ought to be done by the Defense Department. The Defense Department has the opportunity to talk publicly about these things because it is not under the same restrictions that a covert program would be. And I think that's very important. It's important when things go wrong, but it's also important to be able to dispel some of the attacks that are made in terms of propaganda by the other side. The other side will always claim that any strike was on a wetting. That's part of the standard response by our adversaries, and it's important when that's not true, when there are claims of civilian casualties that are made that are not correct, that we be able to rebut those claims. And if these operations are not being done by the military, then that's very hard to do.
What's the problem with the CAA running drone program? You say you'd rather have it in the Pentagon. Why?
Well, I think that the Defense Department can be more transparent about it, and I think that we can benefit from all of the same intelligence that we want to utilize in determining what's an appropriate target for a counterterrorism operation, but it allows us to be more transparent. And in terms of other agencies, I really want to see them focus on their base mission, their core competence, which is gathering intelligence. It's the analysis of that intelligence. You know, this war has tragically been with us for a long time, and it looks like it's going to go on a long time ahead of us as long as this scourge of terrorism is with us. And I think that we ought to have those core capabilities within the Defense Department. I think that's where they properly belong.
It seems to be going a very different direction, though. Mark Mazzetti and Matt Apuzzo in the New York Times just a couple of days ago reporting on how deeply involved the CIA is here, how CIA officials overseeing drone attacks have gone up and up in the hierarchy there. Congressman, perhaps yourself, going over once a month to see video of the attacks, people being blown up. This looks very entrenched in the CIA at this point.
You know, unfortunately, that's not something that's been declassified. I know there have been wide public reports about that, but I have to confine my comments really to my advocacy that these kind of counterterrorism operations be handled by the Defense Department.
Congressman Adam Schiff.
I'll discuss in more detail with you. Yes.
Congressman Schiff, thank you for joining us today from L.A.
You bet.
Ben, what can you tell us about why the weight of this has gone so heavily toward the CIA and the influence of the drone masters in the CIA now?
Well, so one of the factors is just that the program originally developed in the CIA, and there's a long bureaucratic claim of ownership by the CIA over the program, which kind of developed as the armed predator kind of came out of the CIA. And so there's a bit of a historical accident behind it. But as with a lot of things in Washington, once one agency has the ball, it can be very hard to take it away from it. And so we've developed a whole series of parallel institutions when the military uses drones than when the CIA uses drones.
Andrew, there was a lot the congressman wasn't willing to say there. How do you interpret the CIA's large hand in this?
Well, as Ben said, you know, it started with the CIA. It was, you know, when they thought that the impulse to arm the predator came when they sent an unarmed predator that caught sight of something they thought it was actually looked like a white dot when you look at the film, but they thought might have been, they presumed from various indications that it might have been Osama bin Laden. And they thought, oh, my God, if we'd had a missile, mm-hmm. we could have got him then. It's really become, and in a way, it's become the raison d'etre of the CIA. I mean, you know, the counterterrorism center, which, you know, had failed so signally for 9/11, I mean, the day after 9/11, was suddenly the most powerful and richest institution in the country. And it's kind of gone on like that. And their mission is drone strikes and assassination, essentially.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American drone policy and consequences with Ben Wittes at the Brookings Institution, author of The Future of Violence, Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassin, Michael in Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I spent voluntarily two back-to-back combat tours in Vietnam as skipper of the Swift boat.
Right.
I will just say this. When I hear people talk, what they imagine is real politic, kind of the tough guy talk, sounding reasonable, or maybe as hectoring as that corner you at that caller you had, saying, oh, well, you know, that's what happens, and we have to use those things, and we have to act on this data. Moving a little green marks on a screen and saying, oh, we're going to do a regression analysis, and, you know, we've seen this happen before, and everybody said they were bad guys in that situation. I would never have fired on anybody with that kind of information.
But, Michael, I understand. But, I totally understand. At the same time, you served in Vietnam, you're telling us here, and our images of that war are of no small instances of carpet bombing, of napalm, whole villages taken out. It looks worse.
I lie. That outfit was made up mostly of draftees, okay? When I saw that news, I thought, that's not who we are. Now, number one, because there was a My Lai and many My Lais no one ever heard about, because there were no photographers there, I was not saying what everybody would do. I'm saying, with my experience, I would never have done that. Now, mind you, there were times when we were firing support under special forces bases that were in danger of being overrun. That, Mr. President, is where you start to get into the fog of war. And what a hypocritical statement for him to make. By the way, I voted for him twice.
Michael, we've got it. Deep moral unease with the so-called precision of drones. And I understand it. There's another view that's so prominent in Washington now. Here was John McCain on Sunday on CNN State of the Union saying it's a new form of warfare. We don't have options.
We are now facing a new form of warfare. These non-state terrorist organizations that are spread all over Hell's Half Acre. And really the only way you can get at them that we know of now that's viable is through the drone operations. They have taken out leadership.
Andrew Coburn, McCain, and others saying, what do you want? It's this or we send in troops, and it's very hard to send in troops here. These are the options. And, you know, one way somebody's American sons or daughters are dying. This way, the drone's at least getting some of the work done, and we don't have an option, he says.
Well, really, I mean, drones make us feel good, basic thing. You know, we think we're taking care of the problem. I mean, going back to the, you know, we were talking earlier about the rise of ISIS or mm-hmm. ISIL, whatever you want mm-hmm. to call it. I mean, the reason we thought we'd won, we thought, you know, there was that huge campaign during the surge, which was to basically aimed at eliminating Al-Qaeda in Iraq, as they called themselves then, which was a very energetic program of assassination. I mean, mostly by special forces teams, but the same principle, get the leaders. And, you know, at the end of it all, they thought, well, we can go home now because we've won. And look what happened. It turned out we hadn't won, that they simply regrouped and came back. So the question is, does it really come to, you know, what are you trying to achieve? And clearly, it seems clear to me, this program doesn't really get us where we want to go. I mean, there's, you know, that we should, if we want to really deal with this issue and deal with this, you know, steadily metastasizing jihadi threat around the world, which is expanding, you know, certainly almost daily at the moment, perhaps we ought to rethink what we're doing because it doesn't seem to be achieving the desired objective.
Ben Wittes, what about this line of criticism? Yes, you've got these pinpricks or these precision strikes, if you will, but overall we don't see the jihadi or Islamist threat being rolled back. And what about the reputational price in the drone strikes? It does appear to have made the United States and some parts of the world look like the evil empire, Ben.
Right. So, look, I think whenever you're confronted by a drone strike, you have to ask what the alternative in that situation was. And sometimes the alternative is going to be some lesser use of force, like not hitting a target. The question is whether in the aggregate the alternative is some greater use of force that would cause greater civilian harm, greater risk to our own forces, and greater involvement of the United States in an area of the world in which I think everybody wants to be as minimally involved as possible. And so one way to think about the question is to look at the tribal areas of Pakistan where most of these drone strikes have taken place and where al-Qaeda was based as a safe haven and organizing, and saying, but for the existence of drones, what would the United States have done in that region? Would it have been more constructive or would it have been less constructive and more violent? And I think part of your instinct about how to feel about drones depends on your reaction to that question. And I look at Iraq and I look at Afghanistan and I say it's very unlikely to me that the United States was going to simply tolerate the existence of these safe havens in the tribal areas of Pakistan over the long term. And so I look at several hundred drone strikes as a relatively low-level intrusion, though there have certainly been civilian harms and there have certainly been a lot of people killed. I look at it as a relatively light footprint compared to what I think the likely alternative is likely to have been. But I accept that many people will look at the same data and draw a different assumption because they assume that absent these strikes, we would have had a sort of more purely law enforcement approach or a more purely development-based approach. And then this does look very heavy-handed.
Pull back a minute and look at the spread of Islamist militants. In that strategic sense, is it working?
Well, so I don't think of drones as a strategy. Drones are a weapon. And
they become a primary tool in what's called the counterterror campaign.
Correct. And so I think it's fair to ask, is our larger counterterrorism strategy working? And you know, I'm certain there are reasonable critiques to be made of the approach that we've taken. But I distinguish between that and the evaluation of whether drones are an appropriate tool for use in whatever strategy you come up with.
Andrew, we have just half a minute. Do drones blind us here?
Yes, I think in a way they've become the strategy. You know, they've become the so much now bureaucratic, institutional, corporate momentum behind them that, you know, we do them because we do them. And I'm afraid it's leading us down a rather dark path.
Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. He's author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Andrew Coburn, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Benjamin Wittes at the Brookings Institution, author of The Future of Violence. Ben, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, we will turn to Pakistan and the shooting of a prominent civil rights activist there. This is On Point. In Pakistan on Friday night, prominent activist Sabeen Mahmood was killed, shot five times in her car alongside her mother, who was also seriously wounded, shortly after Sabeen Mahmood had hosted a discussion about human rights violations in Pakistan's troubled Balochistan province with dissidents and other activists. Her death has prompted a wave of anger and grief in Pakistan and beyond. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Beena Sarwar, journalist, author, filmmaker from Pakistan. Beena Sarwar, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Can you please introduce us to Sabeen Mahmood, who she was, and why, some of why her death, her killing, is raising such emotion?
Well, for me personally, she was a dear friend of more than 30 years, so it's a very deep personal loss. And it's hard to talk about her in the past tense.
Yes.
Sabeen was an iconoclastic, maverick, open-minded person who supported all kinds of freedoms. She loved Steve Jobs and Apple. She loved the Beatles. She loved she had opened this amazing space in Karachi where there was a bookshop, an art gallery, a cafe, and there would be readings, plays, so many artists, writers, musicians, filmmakers had their first break there where they showed their they shared their work with audiences. There was open discussion, and they took on contentious issues. And her approach to everything, even people who disagreed with her, was, come on, let's sit down and talk about it. Let's have some chai. Come and, you know, join me for a cup of tea and let's talk about it.
And big picture, Bina, what was Sabine fighting for?
Sabine's basic fight was for human rights and freedom of expression. That is the fight that many of us from Pakistan are engaged in, and we don't feel that we get the support because the focus of the media is always on the bad guys and all the bad things that are happening. Mm-hmm. And Sabine was doing such stellar work for such a long time. She had to scramble to keep it going. And the civil society in Pakistan is under attack from so many fronts right now. And Sabine was very much a part of that civil society, and that is the big picture, the fight for human rights, for freedom of expression, for democracy in Pakistan, which those who killed her don't want to see happen.
Well, more specifically, this looks like an assassination. Who might have or would have wanted Sabine Mahmood silenced, even dead?
Well, she provided a platform for dissenting voices, for open conversation, for questioning, after the assassination, so many people I talked to, their response was they just want to silence us. So it's not just one issue. There are people who are now going to try and appropriate her for the Balochistan cause. But she wasn't speaking about Balochi separatism, which is what one section of the population is called. There's a sliver of population that's calling for that. But she was talking about human rights. That particular seminar at the second floor of her cafe was about human rights and disappearances and the father and the brother of young men who had been disappeared and killed were among the speakers. They were supposed to have spoken at a seminar at a university in Lahore just a couple of weeks ago, which got cancelled. People went in there saying they were from the military establishment, from the intelligence agencies, and said that this should be cancelled. There was nothing in writing. The university administration buckled under, and they didn't have the seminar. And in another city, Sabine agreed to have the same people speak. So she knew the dangers she was facing. She knew that it was dangerous.
But who specifically might have wanted her silenced? I mean, we look from afar at Pakistan. You've got Taliban and religious hardliners in government. You've got military. You've got intelligence services. Where does suspicion lie here?
All of them. I mean, we don't know who killed Sabine. It could have been a mercenary. It could have been mercenaries paid, 10,000 rupees, the equivalent of $100 to fire those bullets. There's all kinds of freelancing going on, equal opportunity, and it could have been anybody.
Who is offended in Pakistan by civil society, by the proponents of human rights, by freedom of expression? Who does that offend and why?
It's what we call the Ghairat Brigade, the honor, so-called honor brigade, the people who conflate religious identity and hyper-nationalism with they conflate the two things. If you are a Pakistani, you have to be a Muslim. If you are a Muslim, you have to be a particular kind of Muslim. And Sabine and those of us who are fighting that fight don't fall into those categories, and we are labeled as traitors and as anti-Islamic, activists or whatever, which is not true. And so the work that Sabine did was very offensive to them. She had started on Valentine's Day a couple of years ago, there were these big banners that had come up saying not to celebrate Valentine's Day because it's un-Islamic. And so she went and she stood under one of those banners and she put up a sign saying, in Urdu, saying, let there be love, something to that effect. I forget right now. It was silly. It was quirky. It was artistic. And she got threats for it. She took down her Facebook page for a while at that time. Sort of silent for a while, low key for a while. But, she couldn't stay like that for long. And there were many people who would have, wanted that kind of quirky, questioning voice to be silenced. But at this point, it was right after the seminar on Balochistan. We don't know who did it, but we know that she was wanted her to be silenced, and people around the world right now are saying, we will not be silenced. There's a vigil in San Francisco, in London. There's one in Boston, at Cambridge, at Harvard Square Harvard Yard tomorrow. There's one in Islamabad, in Lahore. There are people around the world. This is not an isolated incident.
Mm-hmm.
This comes on the heels of a long line of targeted murderous attempts. Some people who survive and some don't. Hamid Mir, Malala Yousafzai survived, the Nobel Prize winner. Hamid Mir, the journalist last year who was attacked, survived. Raza Rumi, the journalist last year who was attacked, who is now in Washington, D.C., survived such an attempt. And Sabin did not. Parveen Rehman did not. Zahra Shahid did not. There are so many other people. Benazir Bhutto did not. So many people have been killed as part of what you can call it an intellecticide, a targeted, picking and killing of people who are thought leaders who question that hyper-nationalist, hyper-religious narrative.
Bina Sarwar, friend of Sabin Mahmood, killed on Friday night in Karachi. Intellecticide, a new and sad term. Bina Sarwar, journalist, author, filmmaker, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.